So usually we have some fake blood, but today we're kind of out of fake blood. So just use your imaginations, y'all. And we do have a little gunshot scenario.
Pow, pow!
Oh, a gun. Oh, my God. What happened?
She got shot.
She got shot.
Hit me!
You're listening to a training session put on by the People's Community Medics in West Oakland, California. Leslie Phillips and Sharina Thomas started the group because of widespread perception in Oakland's low-income communities of color that in an emergency, even if you call 911, it might take a while for help to arrive. KALW radio reporter Allie Budner followed the medics as part of her year-long investigation into Oakland's 911 system.
So, what you would do in this case is you would look for the entry wound, which is usually a small spot, but the exit wound is a big spot where the blood will be.
This week on Making Contact, we hear part two of The Race to an Emergency, a documentary produced by KALW Radio in San Francisco, hosted by Martina Castro. What are the roots of the historic mistrust between people of color, especially African Americans, and the police? And how does 911 really work? Is slow response time just perception or reality? I'm Andrew Stelzer. Stay tuned.
And so you want to apply pressure on both the entry and the exit wound.
By this time, a small crowd, maybe 10 people, has gathered to watch. A few are taking notes.
So you want to hold the blood in there, keep applying pressure. That's why we handed out these packets with the rubber gloves and the gauze, because that's what you would use. You would put your rubber gloves on. You don't want to touch blood with your bare hands. And you want to use the gauze to apply pressure. You can just use a plastic bag or anything that you can use to seal in the pressure and the blood, rather. So the same thing is that you want to stay there with the person applying pressure until 911 comes. And when they come, then they're going to take over. But you may just be saving somebody's life by doing that.
We are not here to replace 911. We are here to add life to our people before 911 gets there.
Before 911 gets there, that's the key. Because even when help is on its way, sometimes it's not fast enough. So Leslie and Sharina prepare people for that reality by encouraging them to call 911 and teaching them how to jump in when they otherwise might have had to just stand by and wait. That's reporter Allie Budner. So who are people on the scene of an emergency really waiting for? Firefighters may be the first responders, but they're really only treating people until the ambulance gets there, because only ambulance paramedics can take someone to a hospital. They play a unique role in the whole emergency response system, but often people don't realize that and lump all responders together, especially when something goes wrong. Paramedic Jason Murphy takes that broad criticism very personally.
They don't get to see the paramedic holding the old lady's hand all the way to the hospital just because she's scared. They don't get to see us go talk to the 17-year-old resuscitated victim of a cardiac arrest, you know, and get to shake his hand, take pictures with them, and say, all right, we're going to give you a little bit longer life.
Jason Murphy is a supervisor with Paramedics Plus. That's the ambulance company that serves all of Alameda County. So Allie joined him on one of his overnight shifts. The routine of an ambulance medic is a lot like that of other emergency responders. Periods of waiting and driving around, punctuated by short bursts of intense adrenaline.
Yeah, we're driving west, 580, into Oakland, because Oakland is my zone.
As a supervisor, Jason Murphy oversees all the calls that come in during his shift.
I'm basically hooked to the CAD, so CAD stands for Computer Aided Dispatch. I can see all the calls that have gone out in the county, and the information regarding the call, like what it may be for. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
EMS 1102, this is Jason.
And just like that, casual talk is over, and we speed towards a call involving a bicyclist and a car.
These are our sirens right now?
Yeah. People driving home from work, bicyclists running red lights and no helmets on. ceases to amaze me. This is our call.
2.5 minutes after getting the call, we pull up to a West Oakland intersection, already crowded with emergency vehicles. A police officer is interrogating the driver who struck the cyclist. A fire engine and an ambulance are parked, responders already out and surrounding a man who's laying on the street. His bike is beside him.
Hey, we're going to take your helmet off. Your car pop this helmet off.
All
right. Don't move your head. Any pain in your head when I touch your head?
No.
Any pain in your head when I touch your neck?
No.
It all goes pretty fast. The fallen cyclist is whisked away to the hospital by the ambulance. Since Jason is a supervisor, his role is just to help out and make sure everything is running smoothly. Jason says a call can take about an hour and 20 minutes.
From start to completion includes driving to it, getting the patient, doing treatments, becoming available for the next one. We have delays sometimes if we're that busy. This is one of these things where it's just, we could have 100 ambulances out here and still be busy.
Yeah.
It's just, it's the way it goes.
Jason says that's because he gets more non-emergency calls in East and West Oakland.
I think people that are more affluent probably tend to have insurance and or tend to have more education. And they realize maybe, is this a problem where I need the emergency services to show up, or is it a problem where I can just go to my doctor?
They may be busy, but I tell Jason about the People's Community Medics, who feel that responders just don't do as good a job when serving their neighborhoods. He leans away from me and looks out the window.
It definitely kind of makes me a little, I want to say annoyed. I mean, if that's the right word for it. I can certainly sympathize with them feeling disenfranchised for their area, but the reality is there's nobody here that says, oh, I'm not going to drive this call that fast because it's in this area. No, wrong. I could care less skin color, where they live, what their cultural teachings are. Did they get shot in commission of a crime? Doesn't matter to me. I'm going to try to save their life.
But ideally, not at the risk of his own. When I ask him about the staging policy, Jason is unequivocal. It's necessary. And even after staging, he still gets into dangerous situations.
I was on a shooting call, and this was in Hayward. It was in Hayward. It was in the middle of an apartment complex, an older apartment complex. And this poor gentleman was shot on the ground. And all we know is the shooter could be in the crowd up in these upper floor apartments on these balconies looking down on us. And there was a lot of people looking down, what's going on. I can't tell you how uncomfortable that was, you know? The fact that someone wanted this guy dead and someone in this crowd possibly has shot him. And we're right there.
And so are the police. Because after something like a shooting, they have to collect evidence. And that's why the scene of an emergency is inherently messy, with multiple agencies responding at different times, occasionally getting in each other's way. That's why Jason Murphy has reservations about another group in the mix, like the People's Community Medics. Ultimately, Jason thinks the medics could do more good if they worked with existing agencies.
Why don't they go to the county public health agency and say, this is what we're doing in our little corner of the world. We want to contribute, be an adjunct to what's already existing. How can we go about it that would help, you know, people out the greatest?
That's paramedic Jason Murphy with reporter Ali Budner. Coming up, we continue tracing the path of a 911 call with the third responding agency, Oakland Police.
Truly, the joke about 911 is not the EMTs, it's the police. It's the 911 part of us having to go through the police to even get help.
That's when the race to an emergency continues.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Now back to part two of The Race to an Emergency, a documentary produced by KALW Radio in San Francisco, hosted by Martina Castro.
Welcome back to The Race to an Emergency, a documentary from KALW in San Francisco. I'm Martina Castro. Reporter Ali Budner joins me now in studio. Ali is going to continue tracing the path of a 911 call by taking us on a ride-along with an Oakland police officer. But first, we want to take a step back. There's a lot of history that goes into the relationship between police and Oaklanders, especially African Americans.
It's why the founders of the People's Community Medics say their concerns with 911 are not exactly about the firefighters or the paramedics, but about the police.
Antagonism between the police and African American communities has been ongoing for quite a long time.
That's Benjamin Bowser, a sociology professor emeritus at Cal State University of the East Bay. He's studied race relations in Oakland for decades.
Well, it started with the recruiting of Southern whites as the police force in the 1930s.
There was an influx of African Americans to Oakland at the time. Many were fleeing the Jim Crow South. And in the 40s, people were coming for jobs in the booming shipyards. Between 1940 and 1944, Oakland's black population increased by 250%.
Benjamin Bowser says this triggered racism that spread through the job force and housing market at the time.
If you were black, you could not buy a home in Castro Valley. I remember very clearly when you got to the Oakland-San Leandro city line, the San Leandro police were right there waiting for you, and half the time they'd stop you if you were black.
Racial tensions intensified over the years, and across the country, this culminated in the race riots of the 1960s.
Firemen were harassed by snipers and brick-throwing hoodlums as they attempted to control the fires, many of which were left to burn themselves out.
Law enforcement's brutal response to those riots gave rise to groups like the Black Panthers.
And the police are there not to, in our community, not to promote our welfare.
They basically said, well, look, you know, the police are going around the neighborhood brutalizing people. They're not doing their job. Someone needs to monitor and watch them. So the first Panther activities were to follow the police with arms. But then the drug war hit. I mean, we can date things for East-West Oakland, pre-drugs and post-drugs.
By the 1980s, Oakland was a focal point in the war on drugs.
That set the stage for the infamous case of four Oakland police officers in the 1990s who called themselves the Rough Riders.
The Riders were a group of police officers who patrolled East and West Oakland, and they were noted to be very effective, very good. They tried to be the first ones to respond, to be on the scene, and they eventually were caught planting evidence and giving false testimony on people who they arrested.
There were more than 100 plaintiffs in this federal civil rights lawsuit, and they ultimately settled with the city for millions of dollars. Three of the four officers were acquitted. The fourth fled the country.
As part of the settlement in 2003, the city had to agree to major reforms in the OPD, and the department was assigned a federal monitor. Now, a decade later, the department still hasn't met all of those mandated reforms.
There's been no reform in police practices that produce that kind of culture and mentality. You have a continuation of the war on drugs and police harassment. There are just fewer of them. Then it's no coincidence that people say 911 is a joke, not simply because you don't get a response, but when you get a response, you get a heavy-handed response.
Again, Sharina Thomas of the People's Community Medics.
We're not even safe from the police with our kids riding up and down the street and all of that stuff. We're not even safe from that. So they killing our kids.
When Sharina says police, that term really extends to all officers who carry guns.
And when she says our kids, she's mostly talking about young African-American men, like Gary King Jr., killed by an OPD officer in 2007. Oscar Grant, killed by a BART police officer in 2009.
Derek Jones, killed by an OPD officer in 2010. Raheem Brown, killed by an Oakland school police officer in 2011. Alan Bluford, killed by an OPD officer in 2012.
Since the year 2000, 39 people have been killed by Oakland police officers. At least 19 of the people shot were unarmed. That's according to a 2013 San Jose Mercury News investigation.
Sharina Thomas says her concern is not only for those shot by officers, but also for their families.
Our heart breaks when these mothers cry. We run like we are the ambulance to these mothers, and it's heartbreaking, and I just wish that we would be recognized enough to where we can add help into our communities and not treat us like we are the enemy.
We've had these highly publicized incidents at least once a year. This has been absolutely inflamed a new generation of young people who may not have known about the rioters or the early Southerners who patrolled the police department. But it certainly gives them a sense that it's very dangerous to be a person of color in Oakland.
This is The Race to an Emergency, a documentary from KALW in San Francisco. I'm Martina Castro. So now let's finish tracing the path of a 911 call in Oakland with the Oakland Police. Here's Allie.
107, 909, I've been a cop at that cover.
Brian Murphy's beat is in West Oakland.
It's a mix of residential, a couple kind of commercial streets, San Pablo Avenue, and then a lot of...
From the front seat of his patrol car, I see that mix as we drive down San Pablo. It feels strange all of a sudden to be looking at this street I know through the frame of a police car window. People and places seem distant, as if I'm watching them on a movie screen. And I notice the people noticing the police car. A call comes in. A security guard at the Sears in downtown Oakland says he saw a man who might have a gun in his waistband, and there could be another guy with him.
So we're going to try to meet up, tactically pull ourselves together, get some sort of a game plan.
What's going through your mind right as you pull up to a scene?
Well, right now, I mean, it's our safety. It's the safety of the officer I'm with, who's covering. He's going to be covering me.
We pull up to where they've located the suspects.
Hang out right here for a second.
He and six other officers approach the scene. It's uncomfortable to watch. The officers are aggressive with the suspects. I can't hear what's going on, but it looks like the men are cooperating.
Okay. So, they don't have a gun on them.
What am I letting?
From what the loss prevention guy at Sears saw, what he described to us, it appears that he did not actually see a gun. One of these gentlemen did have was a bottle of tequila that he said he was holding underneath his front belt.
We drive a few blocks and park, where Brian can take notes on what just took place. Brian says when responding to a call like this one, where someone is possibly armed, he has to prepare for the worst.
In this circumstance, I mean, granted, this is downtown Oakland on a Friday afternoon, so there's a lot of people out here. You have to be concerned, again, for the citizens being safe. We need these two people who are being detained to be safe.
Do you see, in any piece of the puzzle, do you see racial profiling as something that factors into it?
No, I don't. But as you know, I mean, it's anyone from any color, race, religion... background can have a gun, regardless of what they look like.
Back at OPD headquarters, I get the official response on racial profiling from Communications Supervisor Regina Harris-Gilliard.
There's cultural diversity training and there's community policing here, so the department has all kind of training requirements when it comes to dealing with the community and those people of diverse cultures. It's a part of our continuous professional training for officers that's done.
Brian says he doesn't see race affecting his work as a police officer, and he has gone through the department's diversity training. But still, racial profiling has been a big problem for the OPD as an organization. Just this August, for example, a report by the ACLU and two other groups found that the Oakland police were disproportionately arresting African-American youth. In 80% of these arrests, there wasn't enough evidence to prove they had done anything wrong.
We have a tendency to get more calls from districts 5 and 6 in the city. That's out in the east end of town. I think most of our calls are in those areas.
Areas where the majority of residents are African American. Jonna Watson is the public information officer for OPD.
Typically, that's where we have shootings,
we have disturbances where people are arguing and aren't getting along, or we have stabbings or other types of crime.
And Officer Brian Murphy says they are often under intense pressure.
Some scenes can be extremely chaotic. If it happens in a crowded area, you could literally have 10, 20, 30, upwards of literally 100 people can come out, surround the area.
So that's when officers rely heavily on their training. It's a major part of how they approach their work, even when they're not actively responding to an incident.
There's little training and tactics things that we do, you know, when we park our cars, when we go and get, coffee or use a restroom at a gas station. I mean, there's ways that we position ourselves so we can see the doors. We know who's coming in, who's coming out. A lot of it, after a few years, hopefully becomes kind of a sixth sense. But you need to practice a lot of these tactics so you don't get stale, so you don't slip up. Because the day, you might slip up, something could happen. Who knows?
That constant need to be ready for something to go wrong and to not slip up, I can see how that approach could put residents on edge around an officer. So even though Brian says most of the feedback he gets from Oaklanders is positive, sometimes
we'll get to a scene where someone, sees the fire department coming or the paramedics or the police, and they will, maybe drop an F-bomb and say, "I don't want your help, I don't need your help." And again, that could be for a variety of reasons.
Brian wishes people could hold on to the instances when things go well. But he doesn't see a way to heal from what's happened in the past without having more communication.
Maybe, an officer can, once you do develop a relationship, can help explain why we do some of the things we do, whether it's, tactics or the way we approach calls.
And do those conversations happen?
They do. They do happen. I'm fortunate enough to have had those conversations again with people who I've arrested in the past. And they'll say, they'll ask questions about why we did what we did, and sometimes they'll give insight on why they did what they did, too. Who knows? But I think, obviously open and honest conversations can help everybody.
That's Officer Brian Murphy speaking with reporter Ali Butner. You're listening to The Race to an Emergency, a documentary from KALW. I'm Martina Castro, joined by reporter Ali Butner.
We began this hour with a question. Is 911 really slower in the neighborhoods that Sharina Thomas calls urban communities of color?
On the medical side of things, meaning firefighters and paramedics, it turns out the answer is yes. The longest response time for regular medical calls is in a neighborhood in East Oakland, and it's 9 minutes.
But when it comes to calls for violent injuries, it's not as dramatic a difference. The longest wait time is actually in the North Oakland Hills at 6.5 minutes. The next highest are in East and West Oakland, hovering around 5.5 minutes.
And as we said earlier, when it comes to the scene of a crime, police are the responders who really determine how quickly someone gets help. Their response times are a bit trickier to calculate because the OPD doesn't consistently keep track of them.
We found this out after many conversations with crime analysts and communications officers at OPD. Their chief of staff, Holly Joshi, said thanks to the questions we raised, the department is now going to update procedures and equipment so they can do a better job of documenting their response times.
For now, the only average response time we have for OPD is 17 minutes, which was reported earlier this year by the San Francisco Chronicle. But there's no way of knowing yet how that average breaks down by neighborhood.
So while we haven't been able to fully answer the questions raised by the People's Community Medics, what's become clear is that behind all of the policies and procedures, frustrations and emotions are individuals who often don't communicate until there's an emergency, until someone calls 911.
There was one such encounter on an Oakland street corner in late November of 2012. There, all the emergency responders and the People's Community Medics came face-to-face over the body of a dying 19-year-old male. He was the victim of a gunshot wound. The following morning, Ali met up with the People's Community Medics on that same corner.
It's a cold November morning when I meet up with Leslie and Sharina at the corner of 61st and San Pablo in North Oakland.
Last night, they were here under very different circumstances.
When we got here, we saw a boy laid out in the street who had obviously been shot, and he was being attended to by four paramedics from the Oakland Fire Department.
The police were also there,
who began taping off the area with crime scene tape and pushing us out of the area.
Emergency responders were already in action, so Leslie and the other community medics just watched.
There were a number of people from the community around on the sidewalk watching as well.
From what they could see, the victim was getting appropriate treatment, and he was taken away to the hospital,
where I presume he died.
They don't know his name, just that he was riding a bicycle.
And somebody came out of a building on this block and shot him.
And how did that affect the feeling of the event that you?
Well,
were doing?
That really disturbed all of us tremendously because we were watching a life being taken away, you know. And it's a painful thing to watch a young person, especially a young person, die in the street from a gunshot wound.
What was also painful to Leslie was to see 30 people standing around looking like they didn't know what else to do.
People really, truly care about youth and the violence. And I know people would want to do something if they knew. If they knew what to do, they would do it.
So Leslie and Sharina are here today on this corner to do a smaller version of their basic first aid training.
We just know that there's a great need to be self-sufficient, and we know that what our children is going through is something that we can't no longer get used to. We're dying. We're dropping like flies. This is a 911. This is an emergency. This is something that should be broadcasted all around the world.
It's not the individual that is the problem here.
Again, sociologist Benjamin Bowser.
It's not an issue of two women who are crazy or a bunch of people who are in in positions to respond and they are just indifferent. That's generally where the story goes. The problem is in the organization of the response.
What Benjamin Bowser is talking about goes beyond improving response times or educating people about complex policies. It's really about rebuilding trust so that all people can dial 911 and know they will get help.
The Race to an Emergency was a production of KALW Radio in San Francisco. It was reported by Ali Budner, edited and produced by Martina Castro and Alyssa Kapnick, and mixed by Seth Samuel. Ben Trefney was executive editor, Holly Kernan, news director, and fact-checkers were Mary Willis and Ray Sue Sussman. Special thanks to the People's Community Medics, Paramedics Plus, the Oakland Police and Fire Departments, and Joshua English with the Alameda County Public Health Department. KALW's website has more interviews, stories, photos, and data maps that show the concentration of calls to 911 in Oakland, as well as response times. That's kalw.org. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to download or stream parts 1 and 2. You can also subscribe to our weekly podcast or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.